This is the Next Bite of Life podcast, the place to be to hear personal stories from expats, digital nomads, and everybody else taking their next bite of life. Thank you for joining me on this episode of the Next Bite of Life podcast. My name is Kem Kem, and my guest today is Stuart Gatzi. And Stuart is a world traveler, a daredevil. I mean, I have so many other things. Author, there are so many things. Singer, there's so many ways to describe him. And it's so fun and really nice to have him on the show. So we're going to get to know all about Stuart's life. And it's going to be exciting. So I hope you stay tuned for this episode. Hi, Stuart. How are you?
Hey, Kem Kem. It's good to be here. How you doing? Okay.
It's nice to have you. Thank you so much. I know we have quite the time difference because you're in Ho Chi Minh City, right?
Yeah, in Vietnam at the moment. Yeah.
Wow. How long have you been in Vietnam?
It's coming up to 4 years on and off, but in total, yeah. It's been my base of operations for a while.
Oh, cool. Now, before we delve into the Vietnam part, we're going to start from the very beginning. Now, you're originally from Zimbabwe, right, in Southern Africa. So,
right.
How long were you there? Like, what was the circumstances for moving to, and wait till I tell you where he moved to from Zimbabwe, right?
So basically, I grew up in Zimbabwe up until late teens, and then I moved to the U.S. for college and university, and I spent over 6 years there. And once I was there, and the travel bug kind of bit me, and I've been traveling ever since. And since then, it's been four continents, 15 countries. And I'm far from done. This is a big planet.
That's fantastic. Now, when you left Zimbabwe to go to college, you landed in Kansas City, Missouri. How did that come about? Why Missouri?
So there were a number of circumstances, but the primary thing for me was that my sister was studying there. So naturally, you know, she led the way academically and otherwise. So the aspiration was to, you know, be like my sister and you know, try to do well in school and go live in America. I mean, that's for many kids across the world, you know, you get told that and you're like, oh, wow. Yeah, that's it. You know, it's America I see on TV. I definitely want to go check it out. So that's what I did, and primarily moving to Kansas City, Missouri was for family reasons. But then I actually ended up really liking the place too. So,
now, how was the culture shock from there? You know, from from Zimbabwe to Kansas City. What was the culture shock like?
Well, I mean, if you look at Zimbabwe in context, you know, former British colony. So by and large, everything education-wise and official-wise was very much English or British. Yes. And in moving to America, everything was the opposite. You know, people were much more, you know, just confident in saying what they want to say. You know, maybe a lot of times I found that humility wasn't necessarily the biggest commodity I found. People were super confident. Another thing,
even
for
when
example,
they didn't know what they were talking about, right?
well, right. And that also taught me a lot of things, and just to be confident in who I was, irrespective of what, you know, people thought of me. And another thing was that I just found everything just bigger, you know, bigger cars, bigger dogs, bigger people, bigger food portions. So that was a big adjustment for me. And then something as simple as, you know, driving on the right-hand side of the road.
Oh, yeah.
Initially confused me. Yeah.
I remember
one time when I was learning to drive, a friend took me driving for the first time. It was a big open space, so there were barely any cars. And then I was driving, I was going okay. And then he said, hey, Stuart, is there any reason why you're driving on the left? So I remembered quickly, and then I readjusted. And so it's those little things that kind of added up.
Yeah. That was one of the reasons why, you know, we lived in Malta for a little bit, and, you know, they used to drive, they drive on the other side. And one of the reasons I was like, no, thanks, I'm not even going to attempt this, because, you know, I would totally forget. And I can't tempt like that.
Yeah. And you'll find that something even as simple as crossing the road, you start worrying because you're thinking, okay, am I looking the right way? So things like that just kind of threw me off, but it was great because, you know, people around were so polite. And that was my experience of living in Missouri and the Midwest in general. Like, people are just generally so nice, and, you know, you could be walking down the road and someone says, hey, how you doing? And
oh, wow,
you've never met these people, but there's a community feel about it.
Oh, that's really good to know. I hadn't pictured it like that at all. You're the first person I've ever met from Kansas City. So I'm really shocked, because I thought for sure you would have problems.
And, you know, do you know what, though? I think what I also dealt with typecasting after having, when I traveled outside of Missouri, because a lot of people would ask, what are you doing in Kansas City? I'm like, well, I live there. What are you doing here?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And, you know, for example, I'd meet a fellow African Americans, and then they'd ask, like, how are they treating you over there? And I'm like, how's who treating me?
Exactly.
Because I never really, I was fortunate in the group of people I was around. I was never made to feel out of place. And by and large, you know, it was diverse. I think also having fellow international students as well, who were there to kind of, you know, you could share these little things with, it helped as well.
I felt the same, you know, because I moved from Nigeria to Boston, and it was sort of the same thing. People are like, Boston, oh my God, it's the most racist city in the world, you know? And it's just like, I didn't have any problems because, you know, you just go to, you do your thing, you go to school, and there's so many international students, like you said, so many cultural differences that were explored, and it was a great place. You met people from all over the world, Iran, and I mean, you name it. So the place that you were, the area that you were in Kansas City, was international like that. So it was a very nice upbringing and a very nice introduction to the country, right? It sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it was by and large like the family friendly environment. And I discovered, you know, my love for, you know, some American sports, even though I didn't quite fully understand at the time.
Like football?
Initially, I couldn't wrap my head around this American version of rugby that I thought was ridiculous until I actually went. I went to Arrowhead Stadium, and I watched a game, and I was just in love. And I've really? Been a huge fan ever since. Yeah. Oh,
so then you switched from soccer to completely football, American football?
No. I still have both. I'm about having my cake and eating it.
Okay, good. So what is your favorite soccer team then?
I've been a Newcastle United fan since I was 6 years old.
And will
never change. Yeah.
Wow. Now that's really weird. It seems like every person I've ever met, it's Man U. That's it. It's Man U or Liverpool. There's no, you know, and a few sprinkled in Chelsea people there somewhere. So it's nice to hear Newcastle.
Yeah. Yeah, and that comes mainly from my childhood. When I was a kid, I had switched on the TV, and at the time, you know, Newcastle were known for playing entertaining football, and I was like, oh, I like these guys. Obviously, things changed over time, but you know, I think your team is like religion; you can't change.
Exactly. Yeah. I live with one of the soccer football nuts here, so I know exactly what you're talking about. No matter how badly they do, he's like, that is my team. That's it. You know?
That's it. Yeah.
So now, when you were in Kansas City, did you travel around the country, or were you saying to yourself, I need to get out of America? Or did you you know?
I was fortunate that I got opportunities to travel across the country. I made it out to California. I made it to Anaheim, LA. Did the typical tourist thing, did the Chinese theater in Hollywood, and I was
Of
like,
course.
"Wow, wow, this is it. It looks a little smaller than on TV." But
Yes, exactly. That's what everybody said. I lived there for like 20 years, and that's exactly what everybody that would visit would say. It's like, this is it. Like, it's not like the movies, you know?
Yeah, and then I also took a road trip with some friends once, and we just drove all the way to the East Coast from Missouri once. We made it all the way up to New Jersey and passed through every state. It took us about 4 days of driving and stopping, but yeah, so I did do some traveling. I made it out to Orlando, Florida.
Nice.
And that was through some a company that I worked, so I took advantage of that. Yeah, so I did manage to see good chunks of the country.
That's great. And so when did the urge to leave America after 6 years, like what brought about that change?
I think overall there was a specific incident that involved law enforcement, and more specifically, it was more a case of misunderstanding than anything else. But that spiraled out of control and ended up with me disappearing for about a week without anyone knowing where I was. So that put a lot of things in perspective for me with regards to whether or not I saw a future for myself
In America as a
in
whole.
America at large, as a whole. Yeah. So based on that, I think I was fortunate because I had traveled, I'd moved from another place. So I knew that, having a travel document or passport
Yes.
from wherever is a powerful thing. So,
Yes.
I was still quite young. So I thought that it was important for me and for my own growth and education to go and see and live and try and experience other places
And your
across the
own
world.
life, right? Because how often do we see this played out where, you know, unfortunately they're not around to tell their stories anymore. So you at a young age knew that this was where things were headed and you didn't want to be a part of it. And so you wanted to go out there and live, really, literally live somewhere else. That's insane.
Yeah, and the primary driver for me was just safety. Like a lot of it at the
Yes.
time, to be honest, didn't make sense, but I knew that I had to go and see what else was out there.
Yeah.
So that there was a large driver in that, and even in getting support from family to do that,
Yes.
I don't think they fully understood either, but
Yeah.
they supported me in my decisions. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's a sad thing that this has to happen, that this sort of conversations have to happen in this day and time, but here we are. And now, I mean, thanks to telephones and, you know, being able to record video, this was always happening, but now people can actually see for themselves and see that, you know, it's not all tall stories. These are things that are happening to people. So when you left, where was your first place that you left to? Where did you go first?
I moved to Cyprus.
Jeez, you couldn't have
So
picked a
and so I in telling my friends in Kansas City about it, and then they had no idea where it was, and they looked at it on the map, and they're like, "Where is it?" I was like, "Well, it's a European Union territory, and it's kind of on the borderline off the coast of Turkey and Greece, so it could be kind of Asia, Eurasia." And then some of my friends looked at the map and they said, "Hey, the Middle East isn't far from here. Like, you should be careful. Like, there could be a stray rocket that could land on the island." And I said, "Do you understand how many thousands of miles this represents?"
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's just a drop in the ocean, literally, right?
Yeah. And so, yeah, so obviously I had my own fears and my own unknowns and some of my own friends' fears fed into that. And obviously this was also after 9/11. So I was also fearful because I would also later travel to the Middle East. I would also later travel to Dubai.
Wow.
And I had many of those prejudices that had been fed to me, you know, while living in America. So I had to learn to, I had to relearn about the world, in fact, in traveling.
Isn't that sad, though? Like, you know, you know, I tell people all the time that are looking to live, you know, to leave the United States or whatever. And they're like, they're so used to what we're being fed on the news. And it's like pounded into you that, you know, you step outside of here, your healthcare is going to be gone. Your rights are going to be gone. Everything is going to be gone. And you just keep believing it. And of course, you know, it's not your fault. And you have to actually make the extra effort. I mean, other countries, you can watch the news from all over. And it's, you know, pretty much you can watch the news of what's happening there, what's happening there. And they present it to you. These are the facts. But in America, it seems like everything is sort of like a little bit, you know, disguised into in a way that they want you to see it.
Right. And what I find is this, if you think about it this way, and what's different about American media and how it's delivered compared to the rest of the world. Growing up in Zimbabwe, for example, by and large, whatever TV channels you got, whether it was satellite TV or local TV, everyone got the same thing throughout the country. But if I live in Kansas City and there's someone who lives in St. Louis, we have two different dedicated news channels for each of those locales that cater specifically to news in that locale. And then maybe you get a drop or two of national news.
Yeah.
And then maybe half an iota of international news. So the focus is usually very local focused. And yeah, so that, you know, ultimately, yeah, that was one of also the reasons why I chose to leave, because I thought to myself, my way of thinking is becoming narrowed, not because I'm not curious or anything like that, but purely because of the exposure that I have to the media and the narrow focus that they have. Yeah.
How did you find Cyprus then? How was that? I mean, it's gorgeous. I've seen some of your pictures of you diving off the cliffs and, you know, that's one place I still haven't been, no matter, you know, even though I'm so close by. How was that? How was living there?
Cyprus was, for me, very therapeutic. I think after my experience, I was fortunate that I had friends in Cyprus before, and I had met these friends. They were studying in Kansas City with me. So many of them had returned back to their home. And so I moved over there, and by and large, my experiences with people in particular, you know, in both the northern part, which is Turkish, and the southern part, which is Greek, my experiences most of the time with people were positive. I remember going to a Turkish village in the north, and I'd been warned by, you know, by people in the Greek south because of the history and the division that there was in between the two communities. They would warn me, "Oh, don't go there; it's dangerous." And you know, they haven't been there since the '60s, but hey. So I went over there, and I've never been treated so well. You know, I went to this local village. Everybody was trying to feed me and invite me into their home. And I was overwhelmed. And I remember saying to a friend, "Oh, now I know what it feels like to be a Caucasian tourist walking around in Africa."
the novelty, right?
Yeah, right. It is the novelty. Yeah. So that was very, I think I very much needed that at that point in my life, because I felt like I very much felt rejected. Yeah, I felt rejected by sort of everything and everyone. And so through that, I also, you know, picked up a little Turkish as well.
Cool.
So that definitely helped. Yeah.
How long did you stay in Cyprus?
I did a year and a half. So a year on the Turkish side, and then I did 6 months on the Greek side.
Wow, that's so cool.
And And on the Greek side, most of the time I was there, it was summer, so I was it was busy season, busy tourist season. So people came from all over Europe to particular places, and that was a great opportunity to meet people from around the world and network and still have some of the closest friends I have today from that.
That's great. So,
Yeah.
now you went to Cyprus, everything was great. You stayed there a year and a half. Now, why didn't you decide to stay there? Why did you decide to then leave then?
I had achieved what I wanted to achieve.
Which was?
I followed up on an exchange program for school, and I needed to complete that and graduate. And so once I was there, though, I realized that for my career or to progress in any other way, Cyprus was great for particular sectors like tourism. But as far as what I wanted to do and what I was looking to do or to try and find myself, I didn't see that lane. I could have done other jobs. I was offered PR jobs, working on yachts, and I could have done that and been a lazy beach bum for years. But I needed to grow in other ways as well. And I feel like that's one thing I've been good at. I think knowing when I need to grow and knowing whether or not something's right for me. So at that point, I decided, okay, it was time to move on.
To move on. And where was that next destination? Like, where did the adventure now take you? Because now you've gotten the travel bug, right?
Yeah. So at this point, I decided actually it was time to actually return home because I hadn't been back to Zimbabwe in a long time, at least not consistently for a long time. I hadn't lived there since I was a child, and obviously there were things to consider. There were all these political changes and shifts happening in the country, and it was hard to tell what was actually true or not in the end, because you're dealing with
The
once
news.
again media,
Yeah,
international media.
of course.
And everybody's has some agenda, no matter how impartial they seem.
Yeah.
And so one of the fascinating things that I looked at is, the situation was tough when I moved back. This was the year of hyperinflation and record-setting inflation. But when I was on the ground, it wasn't as bad as it was made to seem in mass media. So, that was also another learning experience for me. So, and then in moving back, there was the element of reverse culture shock as well, because how you left things and how things were, and then where you've been living all play a part in, how I became an adult. So that was an adjustment as well, just in my ways of thinking, or for example, in ways of that we think about service, for example, how we think about service, let's say in America or Canada or Europe, would be different maybe in a Southern African context. I've had experiences where service is not priority. You walk into a
Of
store, for
course.
example, and this has happened to me in South Africa and Zimbabwe and different places. You walk into a store and you just wait and wait, and they can see
That's how it is here in
you.
Spain. They don't say anything, they don't do anything, they keep talking on the phone. They do not acknowledge you in any shape, way of that's just it. They're like, if you need
Right.
help,
Whereas
you'll ask
like
me, right?
Yeah. Whereas like in the US, the moment you walk in, someone is trying to help you. They're trying to sell you something, right? So
Yes.
there were things like that to readjust to, and then readjusting to realizing that at that particular moment it was hard to save, and because of inflation and everything that was happening. But I still decided to stay. I stayed for a while, and I worked for a local architect in Zimbabwe, and that gave me kind of that experience of grounding again and you know, re-looking at where I was from and understanding my culture and everything else. And then at that point, I realized though that I could work and do good things, but I was not really going to, you know, become a world beater and sustain myself financially and try to build something.
Did everybody also feel that you were rich, so you were treated differently? Because, you know, at home, you've got a different accent. They kind of think of you as a foreigner at that point, not even like as a local. So you get different prices. You get treated, you know, nicely sometimes, but not, you know, they want to take advantage of that.
Yeah, there are aspects of dealing with that. But the thing that that helped me blend in Zimbabwe is that, I mean, a good chunk of Zimbabweans have, you know, live abroad or have family abroad or, you know, or in the UK or US or Australia. So many people have come back and, you know, rebuilt their lives. I know many people that came back from the UK and so forth that started businesses. So being sort of like a Zimbabwean returning expat wasn't necessarily
a big thing,
out there thing.
Okay.
Yeah, I found my crowd, of course. Yeah. But if I went to certain places, of course. So that's where speaking the local language helps, and things like that. Yeah.
Then you decide, okay, I've got to move on after a year or two or whatever, and where was the next destination? Like, what is it that actually finally told you it's time now to go out and do something? Was there a specific incident, or was it just like, you know, over time you decided it was time to go?
Oh, right. Yeah, there was a specific incident. I attended the 2010 FIFA World Cup. and I visited Durban, Johannesburg, Cape Town. I went to the Cape Point, Table Mountain, and I literally fell in love with South Africa in that moment. And I think a big part of that was the nature, the natural beauty, number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, I think it was because of the World Cup. Everybody was in a carnival community type atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Everybody was welcoming, loving, and
of course.
And I felt the best connection to South Africa for me was through Cape Town. It was just my wavelength, my vibe, and really, by and large, I think really, really cool people. So after attending the World Cup and attending a few games and you know, making random friends that invited me onto their yacht in Cape Town, which is just amazing.
I can imagine.
it was great, you know, and I certainly, I was like, well, you know what, this place is more developed. I would make more money doing architectural work, and funny enough, my boss, when I was working in Zimbabwe, he kept telling me, the guy that I work for that paid me every month said, Stuart, there's no money in architecture. I am a registered architect with the Royal Institute of British Architects. I'm registered here in Zimbabwe. There's no money in architecture. I make my money from real estate. You need to go do something else. And he kept telling me.
Yeah. Well, somebody tells you, you know, somebody with authority tells you, you have to listen, right?
Yeah. And he's like, you need to go to South Africa, improve your drafting skills and your 3D work and all this stuff. So I listened to him. But then also part of it was my own logic. Like, realistically, I needed to, you know, do something more. because I blew through a big chunk of my savings, you know, returning home. And you know, nostalgia is great, but nostalgia doesn't pay.
I understand that.
And so so eventually I moved, I moved to Johannesburg, which in hindsight for me was a huge mistake.
Really? Why do you say that?
I mean, when you arrive in a city and you get robbed within 2 hours of arriving in broad daylight at knife point with other people, you know, just looking.
Oh, my goodness.
I was like, oh, wow. This is great.
Oh, my God. I am so glad to like hear that, because I almost regretted not moving to Johannesburg. It was a place that we really considered moving to, because we both loved it when we visited. But hearing this probably bolstered my decision, because I'd heard the stories.
Well, so, look, I mean, I should be also open. This is my experience. Yeah. I also know people that have lived in Johannesburg their whole lives, no problems whatsoever. I know people that visit there, no challenges. But I think it's important that I just relay my own experience.
Of course. Oh, definitely. Of course. I think, like, you know, when we went, of course, because we went to do our, every place I wanted to live, I tried to go and see if I like it and try to live like a local. But it was obvious to me that if we were living in Johannesburg, we had to live, and I can't remember the name of the city, it was sort of like an enclave. And if you stayed within there, you were fine. But the minute you stepped outside, then it wasn't so great. So for me, that was the decision point. Like, yeah, I love the food, I love the people, I love the vibe. But if I have to be confined to this little space, then it didn't make any sense. And that was the ultimate tipping point for me. So it's quite interesting to hear that. So when this happened, I mean, it must have been very upsetting to be robbed, you know, during the daylight. How did that taint your feelings about the city?
Well, it was mixed feelings, because I had been there before and it was safer and I was fine. But the thing that threw me over the edge with this whole situation is I traveled from Zimbabwe to South Africa. I landed there. I got robbed within 2 hours. But what I didn't tell you is that the people who robbed me were speaking my own local language. Oh. So it means one or two of them was from Zimbabwe and the others were locals. You know, I like the diversity and teamwork and stuff like that, but I just thought that was ridiculous.
But you were like, thanks for no thanks. This is not the way to welcome me, brother. You know?
Yeah,
oh,
right.
No.
But you know
did
what?
Did you try speaking your language to him? Oh, he didn't care?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was a very customer-friendly robbery. You know, he was speaking very nicely and calmly, and he said, look, this is what's going to happen, and just, you know, let us check. And then I gave them 20 bucks or whatever it was I had. And then he you know, they start walking away and he's like, oh, okay, how are things at home? The whole time he's speaking my language. How's
my
family?
God.
How are things at home? And then he says, take care of yourself. And then I ran.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that is a very customer-friendly service. You know? It's like, look, I could hurt you, but I would. You know, so like, you know, there were a lot of Nigerians and they were kicking them out at some point, because, of course, there are always a few bad ones that ruin it for everybody else. So Nigerians were going there doing the same kind of nonsense. And at some point, they were throwing them all out of there. And then it's like a big thing. Oh, we'll do the same over there. I'm like, well, if they're not going over there to rob, well, you guys are doing it here. That has to be some sort of balance. So
exactly.
So he told you to take care.
yeah, I did. And then I did. I ran into Park Station. I was at Park Station, if you're familiar with that, in Johannesburg. And then I stayed in there. Like, I just stayed
a
hold
big,
up in there.
Parking lot thingy that's huge. Is it that?
Yeah, it's giant bus station.
Yes,
it's kind of like an airport,
yes.
But it's for buses. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So when did you finally leave? Like, how long did it take it for your heart to start beating normally?
Yeah, so luckily when I first arrived in Johannesburg, I was staying with a friend and stuff, and so I just called him and said, "Hey, I've arrived, and this is what happened." And then he said, "Okay, just wait there," and then he came and picked me up.
Okay. So,
Yeah.
but that kind of like made the whole stay. How long did you stay there then after all that?
Do you know what? Actually, I tried to brush it off. And then I stayed and I tried to look for work, unsuccessfully so. And so I started to realize maybe I needed to go and try somewhere else. I heard there was, a pretty decent construction industry happening in Cape Town. So I went and tried that out. And I remembered it being a lot safer too. So after about 6 months in Johannesburg of trying and hitting my head against a brick wall and sleeping on my friends' couches, and I got sick of that, so I decided to move.
Now, Cape Town, you said was much safer. Was that, was there more work available? Was it a better living experience?
For me, it was a better living experience. Of course, there were challenges, but I felt much safer, especially in the city center. I think primarily because there's private security in the city center at all times. And generally the people just seemed to me a lot less aggressive than in
There's some
Johannesburg.
sort of desperation in Johannesburg that's not present there. That's good.
Yeah, and I think part of it is also that just, if you live in Joburg, you've also just gotta have that look or vibe about you that you should, don't mess with
Don't
me because
screw with this one either.
yeah. So I quickly discovered, if I walk around looking angry, people will leave me alone.
No, it's so funny because I have faces that I do, and it depends on where I am. I have the and I always have because a lot of times I'm always smiling, the dimples are out, but when I go like to Egypt or I'm like gangster face, and it's like it's surprising because it's not me at all. Because if somebody said hello to me, the smile breaks out, but the first look is like, come here and you're dying, or we're both dying, or something. So I never get bothered like that, but you have to do that,
Yeah. And these are little ways I've discovered of being your own private security kind of thing. But
But it came too
yeah.
late. It didn't work for you. Didn't know that when you first got to Johannesburg.
I didn't know that. If you think about this, right? Here I literally was this kid from, Harare and Kansas City, just coming, showing up and like, "Hey, what's going on?" So obviously you can imagine. But yeah, it was a quick lesson.
So, Cape Town, and I know you also lived in Dubai, right?
Right, yep.
So you've been
So
to a lot of places. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
yeah. So I spent some time in Dubai. I think that was actually prior to me moving back to South Africa. I had returned to Zimbabwe and then I managed to find work through an agency, working for this construction firm. So I took up the job for a while. Yeah.
So now, when you moved around, like when you left, how many other countries did you go to after South Africa, including a return back to South Africa, you just said, right?
No. I returned to Zimbabwe,
Oh, to Zimbabwe. Okay.
and I guess you can say I went to South Africa after going there for the World Cup the first time. Okay. So you said since I left, which country?
Since you left South Africa. Oh, when you went back to
Okay.
Zimbabwe after South Africa.
Right.
Okay.
So from there, it's been Vietnam, Hong Kong, Cambodia, Singapore, Malaysia. I was gifted a trip to Myanmar, but unfortunately I couldn't use it because of COVID. And I think there's a seventh country I'm missing out. Macau.
Oh wow. Now
It's not a country really, it's a territory.
That's great. Was this all for work, or did you just want to live? You made them your bases, and you were working like you do remote work, right? Still in the architectural business, or you do.
So basically, I took a step back from design and concept design and architectural design. And that was because of a couple of corporate experiences I had that led up to me realizing that I just didn't really like working for
For someone,
other people when it came to construction companies and firms. So I actually quit architecture for a while, and I started teaching. So I went for my teaching certification. I got that, and then I moved to Southeast Asia. I moved to Vietnam, and from Vietnam as a base, I've been able to travel to all these other locations that I have.
Now, how's the cost of living in Ho Chi Minh City?
All right. Oh, okay. Before I get to that, actually, you did ask, was it for work or anything else? So when I traveled here, I traveled for a teaching job, right? But once I got here, I started to grow other aspects of my business. So the writing and the music. So a lot of the times when I was traveling to all these other countries in Southeast Asia, I was while it was for a break, I was actually traveling to tour for music. So I'll be going to
That's
different
great.
venues and playing at different locations.
At this point, I would also like to say that you have a YouTube channel, Stuart Gatzi, and that's spelled GATSI, SY.
That's it.
Yes, because I was like,
S-I.
I tried to, ooh, the brain is not as young as it used to be. And there was,
It's hard.
I heard like a few of the songs you have on there. Very nice, by the way. There
I'm
was
glad you like it.
one that I listened to, and I thought, wow, he sounds like the name escapes me, but I think it was a singer, like a traditional singer from Zimbabwe that I listened to a long time ago, and I couldn't remember, but it'll come back to me and I'll tell you. And there was another one, I think it was Breaking Heart, is it? Is that, does that
All
sound?
right, so it's called Well on My Way.
Well on My Way. That was the first one, but the second one where the girl with the hula hoops is like Breaking Heart.
All right, so that one is called Beautiful Heart.
Beautiful Heart. I have to say that I really, really like that one because I'm the sort of person that listens to a video. I listen to the music that I listened to 20 years ago, and I have not listened to any new stuff from then. And when I listen to songs, like I'm like, eh, 2 seconds, eh, 2 seconds. I listened to the whole thing. I really enjoyed
Oh,
it. That
wow.
was very good. And the suit, yeah, everything about the video was really nice. The suit, the slow motion, it was really good. So well done. Kudos to you on that one.
Thank you. And there's a, interesting story behind, the making of that.
Oh yeah.
While there's a part where you see me singing with the microphone in the suit in what looks like kind of
Yes.
like a restaurant slash hotel.
Yes.
So throughout the course of filming that, the owner of the restaurant was just livid. I don't know. She had agreed to do it, but the whole time she kept saying, "Okay, are you done? Are you done? My customers are coming. When are you
My God.
finishing?" And I had to focus, I had to direct, and I had to deal with that situation. So that was really fascinating.
But it came off
Thank
well, so
goodness.
that's okay. So yeah, because you sing, and this is probably the best point to bring up your book that you've written about your experiences, and it's called The Rough Guide to Planet Earth. Can we see the book, please? Do you have a copy you could hold
Yeah,
up for
sure.
us?
So, so this is Rough Guide to Planet Earth. It is my first book, and basically all those stories I've been telling you about are in the book. And essentially, it's a travel adventure meets suspense with some sprinkling of humor in there. Starts from me traveling in Zimbabwe and going through all the countries I've been in so far.
That's great. That's fantastic. I started to read it and I was like, okay, so this was inspired by a friend who had done the same. So you felt like, hey, I've got a story to tell. And it's a very interesting story. I've enjoyed listening to it. I could go on forever and have you, but I want people to go out and actually purchase this book. You can't hear it all on this podcast. You really need to read it and leave a review on Amazon or something, you know. I'll have the links to the book on the website so that you can actually purchase it. And I think it's a very interesting read. I've started it and I haven't finished it because unfortunately I have a lot of stuff to do. I don't know what, but but I will definitely get to it because it's very interesting and I've enjoyed hearing the stories. Now, I know that there is a lot to read more in the book, but I'll just have you tell me, we'll talk about the cost of living in Ho Chi Minh. And first of all, for people listening, there's a lot of people that, you know, go to get their English as a foreign language teaching certificate. How did you, where did you register? How did you end up finding this job? Is there a website for it or how did that happen?
Well, I'll start by saying, first of all, I think one of the biggest things that's helped me is networking, right? You can get all these qualifications and everything else, but if you're not talking to the right people about what you want to do, then you won't find the right avenues. So to answer your question, I knew what I wanted to do. I knew already that I wanted to teach English in Southeast Asia at some point. Okay. So I went and got my TEFL certificate. And this is one of the many English certifications you can get. There are different levels of it. You can keep adding to it as well. And then once I had that qualification, plus my other previous qualifications, then I knew that I could apply for a job. So usually most reputable organizations will ask for a degree in anything else and a teaching certificate generally. Gotcha. And then I spoke to a friend of mine and he said, you know, Stuart, if you want to make money, you should go teach in South Korea for a little bit. And then I looked at my budget and I realized living in South Korea for me would almost be like living in New York. Some parts are pretty expensive. So then I said, well, that's a little expensive. Do you have any other suggestions? So he's like, well, I'm in Vietnam right now. This is the school that I work for. And then he sent me the website. And so from there, I just got their email and sent in an application and they got back to me within a week. I did a Skype interview and within 2 days and I had already booked my flight to come here anyway, even if I didn't have a job. I was just going to come and visit. And then they asked, okay, when I was coming over, and I sent them my ticket, and they processed my visa, and that didn't take much time. Yeah,
that's great. Now, do you find Well, let me start with this. I know it's hard to think off the top of your head. Like, you live in a one bedroom, like what kind of accommodations do you have and what is the cost of that? Can you sort of give us a breakdown for somebody who's interested in something like that?
Okay, fine. So if you're in New York, for example, a studio apartment, I don't know, it could run you up to $2,000.
Oh no, maybe more.
Maybe more. Yeah, you're right. A studio apartment here, would probably run you about $400, a nice one, $450. That's like city center.
Yeah.
Pretty nice. That'll be serviced with a cleaner as well. So
that's great. So
by comparison, you could see that. Obviously, salaries are lower here, but it matches up. The net that you have after your expenses is probably more than you will have as working in a teacher as a teacher in any US anyway. Sort of city. Yeah.
Does it allow
obviously
you
your
to
qualifications put... play a part too? Yeah.
Does it allow you to put some aside for savings, or is it just strictly working and say, you know, not saving, or can you save also with the work you do?
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously it takes a bit of work, just concentration and actually doing it. But I feel like and many people who move here from across the world feel that they have a greater chance of saving being in this particular position.
Do you know what the average salary would be for somebody who's teaching English as a, like, what would you say your monthly cost is? Don't have to tell me, like, what would you say your monthly cost is for food, electricity, and all that other stuff?
Okay. So food, electricity, your rent, and just your basic entertainment, you could survive on $600 or less. It just depends on you.
And the way, and the food is pretty good. I know Vietnamese food is really good, right? So you have no problems with that.
No, not at all. And the thing is, as well, there are expat communities, just like every other country.
Yes.
There are expat communities where you'll find, if you miss, you know, B-dubs or whatever it is, you will find it. It's all about, I guess, finding your niche, your crowd. But one of the reasons that people do move here for is the quality of life versus the cost of living, and also the ability to save. So it all depends on the individual.
That's fantastic, because, you know, that's one thing that everybody always asks about. Is this something that I can do? And, you know, I love the fact that obviously you've had no fear. You were just like, I want to go here. You look at things and then you decide on a course of action, which a lot of people are so held back by fear. And it's like, oh my God, what's going to happen? And the thing is, you're like a proof, which is what I say to people. You move, you don't like it, move somewhere else. Hey, you move, it doesn't work out, go somewhere else. I mean, like, it's not like, you know, there's no headmaster going, you know, I'm going to beat you because you didn't survive or you didn't make it here. You're proof that you can actually make a life with what you love to do. Here you're working for yourself, you're teaching, you know, you're still doing your music, you're still having your life outside of work, which is what it's all about.
And that's also important for me. For others, it depends. But for me, work-life balance is important. Yes, everyone wants to work. Yes, everyone wants to make money. But you have to balance that. If you work yourself into the ground, you don't have time to enjoy your fruits as well. So
yeah, you'll leave it behind for somebody else to enjoy.
Exactly.
Yeah, and the
they'll be grateful.
And it's like, and the one thing that this COVID has shown us is that life really is short, and you've got to, like, there's a balance, there's a delicate balance, but you've also got to, like, take life by the balls or just, like, shrivel up and die. Yeah, you have to, like, sort of meet it. Are you mad that you didn't get to go?
That I didn't get to?
No, I was just going to say, you mad that you didn't get to go to Myanmar because of the COVID. Well, please finish your train of thought, and then we can hit on that.
Right. So I think one of the reasons that I wrote the book for me was a near-death experience.
Oh.
And I write about that in the book, and I'll allow you to, you know, find that in the preface of the book.
Yes.
But that by and large just gave me that kick up the behind that, hey, you have a lot to do. You have a lot you want to do. Why aren't you doing it? And I also found myself getting to a point where I had friends who were just, in my perspective, ambitionless, just happy to just sit and survive and consume a salary and emit carbon emissions. That's it. And that started to frustrate me. For some reason, it started to frustrate me. And so I channeled all of that and all of my thoughts. And also part of it was that many people just saw me as a dumb musician. And a good chunk of that was to be like, okay, this is my brain. I'm not just a musician. I'm a four-dimensional being. There's more to me than just that.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. And I think it it would also encourage people to follow their dreams because, you know, that's what you've done. And this shows you, I mean, you're not like 70 years old and go, I wanted to do this and I just thought about it. You're just like, yeah, I done it. You know, I did it years ago and that's it. And you're still young and you can enjoy it and have all the stories to tell. And you know,
Right.
how many times have I seen people, we still talk about this old man who was like 70 something, and really just moved like, and he's like, you know, so my husband is like, oh, you're from Italy. I have to go to Italy one day. And he's like, one day? What the fuck are you waiting for? You know, like,
Go
it's
now.
like, yeah, exactly. Go now, you know? But people don't do it and they talk about doing it. And it's always fun to talk to doers as opposed to the dreamers. Yes, I know people cannot, everybody cannot say, hey, I've got all the thousands of money, you know, all this money piled up and I want to use it. But for a lot of people, it's an achievable dream, but the fear holds them back so much.
Right,
Now,
right.
I know I promised you an hour and we've gone over it, so
Okay, don't
let
worry
me
about it.
ask you one final portion of the, well, second to the last portion anyway. So how is it, you've been living in Vietnam for 4 years now. How is that? Do you feel any sort of discrimination? Do you feel like, no, I shouldn't be here? Or do you feel like, hey, I could still stay here for a lot longer?
Well, I will put it this way. I think that across the world, I've been fortunate and unfortunate to be able to sample different types of discrimination. In Vietnam, I'm more of a novelty. You will get And that I think a lot comes from a lack of exposure,
Of course.
just to people who look different.
Of
So
course.
my white friends get stared at as much as I do. So it we're, which is fascinating to me because they can sort of now relate to how I've felt before. So you do get that, but then. So as far as discrimination and on a level, I would say that I probably maybe had it more in the US and South Africa. But there are still also very traditional beliefs, basically, about people of color here. A lot of it comes from history, some of it comes from colonialism. But by and large, if you're looking at particular sectors, for example, if you're looking at the English language sector, it's in your favor to be a white male, because I pretty much feel like you can waltz into any job with
Yeah,
standard
they've got a blank check,
qualifications.
right?
Yeah. Whereas, in my instance, I have to trip over myself to prove, include my publications in my applications to even be, considered.
Considered, yeah. So you have to
There
be
is
three
that.
times as good.
Yeah, right. So there is that to deal with. This happens in a lot of, different organizations, but there are some organizations that are more international leaning and open-minded. So that's where, if you're good at what you do, then you can find purchase in that.
But you know,
But
you said, you know, you felt more at home there than in the US and South Africa. Would you now say, okay, I've been to Vietnam and I understand it's newer for them. It's like, you know, before everybody was rushing to Thailand and, you know, that was the place to be. But now, because of all the rules and everything, it's spreading out to all these other places and Vietnam is becoming popular. So that will change as time goes by. Is there any other place that you desire to live that you've considered, or are you content right now is what I'm trying to say, or is there some place that you're saying I still want to go to?
Well, at the end of this particular book, and this is volume one, I specifically state that if you think I'm finished, you are confused. I'm nice. Far from it.
Very nice.
So yes, there are many other places I'd love to go and check out. I need to go and invade Europe with my music, just my music alone.
Yeah.
and
why not?
I would love to visit South America. I'd like to check out Canada as well, just as points of interest.
Yeah.
So there are a number of places, and then I am fascinated by art history and architectural history. So you know,
Europe
places
is the place
is,
to be.
You know, Europe is the place to be, but places as far off as you know, historical places like Mongolia that play key part in our history. I'm fascinated by that too.
That's
so yeah. And then without question, I have to visit more African countries. I have to. I've you know, done Southern Africa as every Southern African should, but I need to visit more. Yeah.
Oh, that's good to hear. Question for you. What would be your advice to somebody who is thinking of doing the same thing, a young man out there, young woman out there who's thinking of traveling? What would be your advice to someone who wants to do what you're doing, live life by themselves, teach English, whatever it is?
I think that the biggest hurdle that people face is that they see this as a bigger challenge than it actually is. This is something for me that I know that is within the grasp of a lot of people. Like, you don't have to have a lot of money to start traveling or to go somewhere. You could travel for school, you could travel for work, and especially if you're traveling for work purposes, then you know your income's taken care of. But I think the biggest factor, I think, is fear. Most people are afraid to leave their comfort zone. And it only takes that one time for you to leave. Even if you have a bad experience, I feel like by traveling to another country, you open up your mind in ways that are difficult to do if you stay in the same place. So if I could give a gift to every single person on the planet, it's a passport and the ability to travel. I think that's very important.
Because it really does change your perspective, doesn't it? It really broadens the mind. It's not just, you know, BS that people spout. It's true. As a last thing, show us that cover of the book one more time.
Sure. There you go.
Rough Guide to Planet Earth by Stuart Gatzi. So like I said, I'm going to have everything about the book and the links on how to get in touch with Stuart and listen to his music and everything all listed in the blog post at nextbiteoflife.com. If you've been enjoying this podcast, please make sure to subscribe on whatever platform you're listening from, whether it's Spotify or Apple or any of the other stuff that I barely know the name of, but we're on anyway. Stuart, thank you so much. I mean, there's so much more that I still want to ask you, but I think we'll keep it at this. Otherwise, I'm sure that I know it's been long. I'm sorry I kept you this late, even though I promised not to. Two, I want to see you here. So everybody, make sure you listen to his music. Go on YouTube and check out Stuart Gatzi and listen to some of the wonderful songs on there. And I wish you the best of luck. And it's been great talking to you once again. Thank you so much for joining me, Stuart. It's been great. Have a good day, everyone.